if you can really listen to your tools, right? If you really pay attention, they will tell you if they're in good shape or not. They will give you feedback. And, you know, in the plane, that might be a slightly different vibration. When I'm winding a watch, it might be that I can feel just a little catch that didn't used to be there, from my Leica to my airplane to my favorite watches. All these things are going to outlive me. And so I'm just a custodian of these fantastically engineered mechanical devices. And I want to be the best custodian that I can possibly be.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week, we've got an awesome doubleheader for you. I'm super excited about it. Up first is my conversation with photographer and pilot Evan Robinson, who you might remember from the Pilot's Journey video series we created with IWC back in 2019. While Evan's day job is creating incredible photographs and films for a wide variety of brands and clients, he's a passionate aviator who also always has a camera with him in the cockpit. That he's a watch lover from a family of watch lovers only makes him an even better fit for this show, and someone I'm always happy to connect with. We get into how he became a pilot, why the toughest flying often results in the best photos, and how the definition of a tool watch might need to be expanded a little bit. After that, Cara joins me to discuss the column she recently wrote for the site, arguing that all watches should be unisex. It elicited a ton of feedback from the Hodinkee community, from other folks in the watch media, and from the industry itself, and we address a lot of those questions and issues directly. If you're interested in watches in any capacity, this is really important stuff, and I appreciate Cara coming on the show to give us a more in-depth look at her column and where we can go from here. So, without further ado, let's do this. Hey man, how's it going?
It's going well. Glad we're finally getting to catch up, especially now that you've been West Coast for a little while. It's overdue.
I know it is. It's crazy. We're like not that far from each other, but COVID reality is that that doesn't matter much, right?
No, we're still worlds apart, but I'm glad that we have a few ways to still keep in touch now.
Yeah, same. What have you been up to? I mean, I guess like I ask everybody this question these days, but like, it's been almost a year now. Like, what your world is about getting out into the world. So, like, what have you been doing?
You know, we were pretty fortunate that early on in this, we ended up finding a dream house that had a new studio for me to remodel. And so, sticking around has been a little blessing in disguise. So, we did a new house, a new puppy, a new studio, and some exciting projects kind of trickled throughout. So, what we expected to be a little bit of a reset year actually was really full steam ahead.
That's amazing, man. That's a new house, new studio, new puppy might be like the perfect trifecta.
Yeah, it's keeping us busy. And, you know, it really makes you want to stick around, which is great, right? We're watching more movies than we used to. And that's kind of our version of travel. But otherwise, you know, it's pretty thrilling to watch our pup develop, to try and implement the things I wanted for a long time in a space that I could shoot and create in. The fact that that space is also now the safest place for me to work is kind of a wonderful thing.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, you've still been getting out there, though, a little bit. And I mean, being able to fly your own plane definitely helps on that front. But if I was seeing what I thought I was seeing, you took a hell of a trip this past week.
Yeah, I think most good adventures start with a kind of simple premise. And this one was I had a friend that got a new airplane and he wanted to safely retrieve it. And we thought that that would be a nice little couple day journey. What we didn't consider is that we were trying to fly a fabric airplane across 14,000 foot mountains in the middle of winter, and that it might get a little snowy. So we really ended up with a total adventure, met some great people along the way who helped us eventually make it from California up to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and then all the way down to the Florida-Alabama border. So we loved it. And it was a nice little break from work, but we bit off a little more than we could chew at the beginning of that one.
How many days did it take you to get from the LA area through the Jackson area and then out to Florida, basically?
Yeah, so really it's getting from LA up to past the Salt Lake area. We ended up with a big weather system that was kind of our stopping point. So one day from LA up to kind of Salt Lake area, the next day up to Jackson Hole. After that was actually smooth sailing. We made it all the way to the Florida area just in another day.
Okay. Okay. Amazing. And then you had to do all of that in reverse?
So in reverse, it ended up being a little bit quicker because we had a new plane to fly. So we, which certainly helped things. But yeah, on the way back, we had great weather and I ended up spending almost 11 hours airborne in a single day, my first day doing over 1,000 miles in our little plane. So it was really nice, a very meditative activity.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. I mean, that also must be in a certain way, like kind of exhausting to be like keyed in at that level for 11 hours.
You know, it seems like it would, but it was a trip that ended up having a lot more training than I expected. So what I got the chance to do was to fly the same type of airplane and get trained in it that my grandfather used to fly. So the plane that I first was in when I was a 3-month-old baby, I got to take a check ride in getting a certification to be able to fly that on what would have been my grandfather's 90th birthday. And to spend 11 hours flying home after that, kind of digesting it and thinking about the entire process, both trying to really internalize the training, but also, you know, it was an emotional thing to do. So coming back, it wasn't tiring. I actually woke up the next day at 6:30 in the morning, energized as ever. It was a really great process.
That's so awesome. I absolutely love that. Well, I mean, we first met through your love of aviation and through your flying because you were featured in our series that we did with IWC, The Pilot's Journey, back in, late 2019? Which feels like a million years ago. Feels like a completely different universe from the one we live in now. But you worked super closely with Gray and our production team on that project. And I wonder kind of like, do you remember how we like first got in touch with you and how that whole thing kicked off, kind of how you got roped into our funny little world here?
I'll never forget receiving the email because I thought it was a mistake. I was so confused. It didn't make sense to me because I'm always the one behind the camera that somebody would want me in front of the camera. And so I started to figure out like, okay, here's how we can shoot this thing. They're like, no. Turn this around. You're on the other side. And they reached out to me because I had recently done an interview with a backcountry aviation magazine talking about how I love to fly and take photographs, which, you know, is a kind of niche thing to do. There are a lot of people that do aerials, but most of the time it's with a helicopter, or if they're shooting, they're in the back of the plane. They're not the one flying. And so I guess that ended up being fortunately pretty high up on the Google search results. If you looked at backcountry pilot, there I was. And so linked up with Gray and the team and had an absolute blast working with everybody on it.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I rewatched the video 2 or 3 times as I was prepping to have this chat today. And, you know, also as somebody who like kind of moves between being in front of the camera and being behind the camera, as I'm watching the video, like part of me is caught up in the emotional story. And part of me can't help but be like, oh, this shot required 3 airplanes. Like the technical side of this shoot is just like something that like it has not gotten old for me. Like as I watch it, I'm just like, oh, this is crazy. And like, I know that your ideas and like you being able to collaborate with Gray and Sam and our production team like really helped that. Like for them, I think it was fun working with somebody who like had an awareness of those sorts of things. I wonder if it was kind of the same for you. Like, was it fun to be able to be on the other side, but also like have that knowledge of what the production was going to be like?
You know, I think that a huge part of what made it comfortable to be in front of the camera was that it was a really complex aerial shoot. And so it really just felt like I was doing what I would normally do. Right? I was coordinating with other pilots, and then I love telling stories. And so then I get to work with Gray and with Sam. We're just talking about, okay, what's going to make this story come across in the most interesting way? How can we really, you know, bring people into it? And it was one of the most fun shoots I've ever done because of that. We just had such a blast. And there are a lot of times when you kind of walk away from set and everyone says, yeah, you know, stay in touch. And this is one of the only crews where pretty much everybody, we still talk on a weekly basis, which I think really speaks to how well we all got along on it.
That's awesome. I mean, I do want to talk about the like emotional content of the shoot as well. And like your entree into aviation, and you already mentioned it a little bit, was your grandfather, right? So like you've been around aviation your whole life, right?
Yeah. So my grandfather kind of was in the heyday of general aviation. There was a time in the 70s and 80s when we reached the peak of private pilots in the U.S. And he was one of those guys. And he lived in Central California in an area where, you know, if you wanted to drive by car to the next town, it might be an hour and 15 minutes. And if you wanted to go by plane, it could be 15 minutes. And so he was in this demographic where there was a huge utility to having your own personal airplane. It wasn't some luxury item. It really changed the way that he could do business and his friends could do business. But of course, once you already have the plane, then it also changes how you can have fun. And so taking his friends on fishing trips up to Alaska and going into the backcountry is also something that he really enjoyed doing. So when I was growing up, I thought that it was pretty normal to hop on the plane and go to Mexico for lunch. I didn't realize that that wasn't something that everybody did.
That's pretty incredible. Finally,
you go to school, you figure out that that's not the norm, especially living in Southern California, because it's a city where we have a big commercial airport and nobody else had airplanes. And so that awareness came and it grew up, moved to the East Coast. It wasn't a very practical thing to do, but it was always an itch that I wanted to scratch. And so I was really thrilled when I finally got the chance to do it a few summers ago.
And when you did it, I mean, one of my favorite things about this and one of the things that speaks to me the most personally is like you went 0 to 100 basically instantly. Like you were like, I'm doing this, and you went super hard, right?
My thought was that if you're going to be safe and do it, you really don't want to be 1 foot in and 1 foot out. And so I went from never having flown an airplane to having my license in about 45 days. And the national average, I think, is 7 months.
Okay.
And another 45 days after that, I bought an airplane and started putting on about as much time as a ferry operator would, about 200 or 300 hours every year. And I believe the average is 35 hours for a private pilot. So was roughly trying to 10x the speed on everything. And I just felt safer for it. And it was also so much fun. You just get into it and it's like, I want to do this again. Okay, well then wake up earlier, do it twice a day. That was kind of how it started.
The safety thing is something, we'll touch on that a little bit as well. Like I want to kind of talk about that in relation to some of your other hobbies that are similar to aviation in some ways, the safety thing being the big difference. But like as you're ramping up here, like, okay, it's 45 days between never flying and getting your license, like at what point do you start to be like, oh, like I can do this and this can be safe? Like at what point does that initial jitter go away? Or did you just not have any of those initial jitters?
I think that as a pilot, you always, in order to be safe, you have to have a little of that jitter. And I don't think it should ever really go away because we're always planning for outs. The thing about flying is that it's really quite easy when everything's going well. All of the preparation is so that you have chosen ahead of time the exact course of action you are going to take in the event of a failure, because you don't have time to think when that adrenaline starts hitting you. You're not going to make a good choice. And so the training is there so that you're not making choices in the event of an emergency, you're executing unknown procedures. So there's always a little bit of that there, but I would say that after you take, there's this really exciting moment when your instructor finally tells you that you're supposed to do what's called a solo cross country. And that means you're not going to be flying around this home airport that you've known, that you've practiced taking off and landing at. It's time for you to go by yourself in the airplane and fly somewhere. And that could be hundreds of miles away to airspace you've never encountered before. And that's one of the really important steps in making sure that you're going to be a safe pilot. And I was able to time my solo cross country for the solar eclipse. And ended up, so again, it's one of those, you just get a perfect day and then everything starts to feel calm and comfortable and in a whole new way. And so it was one of the most stunning flights I've ever gotten to take, and flew up to Duluth, Minnesota, and unfortunately I couldn't fly to the total eclipse because of how far that would have taken me from my training ground, but I still got to see the partial and had a blast doing it. And after that I felt like, all right, I certainly have a lot more to learn, but at least now I can safely continue to learn on my own as opposed to needing to always have somebody in the right seat next to me.
That's wild. I love that you've been able to kind of like mark your flying career in quotes here. Like your flying journey has been able to be marked with these like concurrent milestones of like other things in the world, whether they're personal or something like the eclipse. That's kind of like a cool way to be able to mark those important moments.
It's one of the things that I think, right, it could be any hobby that you have or anything that, a collector looks to have, but I find that those milestone moments, it's, you usually want to engage with your favorite parts of life during those or around those times. And so for me, since aviation has become such a big part of my life, it's kind of a natural thing that if there's a special day, usually I want to be flying on it.
I also love, watching this video back. One of the quotes that really stood out to me is, "The airplane is a tool, and there's beauty in its function when it's in its preferred environment, in the dirt and the grass, thousands of miles away from anybody else." And this idea of a beautiful tool is really interesting to me. And as somebody who loves watches and cameras as well, which I know you also do, that's just a really like beautiful thing. It really resonates with me. And I wonder where that sort of came from in your mind.
I think that it comes from a real love of simple and effective mechanics. I think that I've made a living holding something in my hand, right? I sometimes really jealous of the folks that can, I suppose a writer does hold the pen, but effectively right now it's typing. You know, it's not the same thing, right? If you are only working with your mind, I think there's a different type of engagement with tools. But when you have an entire career and a livelihood based off of an interaction with a tool, it's important to just skyrocket. And so, you know, my appreciation began when I was in high school and I bought my first Leica film camera. And that was something that I had been wanting for such a long time. And I remember when I finally held it, I just thought, this is going to change what I create. It's not that I'm going to shoot a different type of film in here than I was shooting a day ago, but I will feel different using this. I will be more thoughtful. I will be more respectful of the subject. I'm going to take more time. And I know that because of that, I can create something better. And so I think from the Leica into getting an aircraft and starting to understand that, you know, the more that I flew it, the more carefully I maintained it, the better care it would take of me. And that was going to be really a rewarding thing to try and embrace.
Yeah. And that taking care is something that I want to stick on for a moment. You know, it's you take care of your tools and your tools take care of you. Like, it really is this sort of symbiotic relationship. And I'm talking about this now from a photography standpoint in my own life. But, you know, for you, again, going back to this trip you just took, like, I saw that when you were up in the Jackson area, like, the plane iced over and you had to figure out how to defrost it and, like, save the airplane, right? Like, and you need to save it for its own sake, but you also need to save it because, like, it needs to be safe for you to fly. Like, it needs to take care of you. And that sort of, like, two-way give and take with an object is, like, a weirdly special thing in a lot of ways, and a thing that I think you're right, like, people who need these things for their livelihoods or who make them a big part of their lives understand. And otherwise it can be, like, I think maybe a bit confusing to people.
There's something about the way which to an outside party can make you seem a little crazy, but if you can really listen to your tools, right? If you really pay attention, they will tell you if they're in good shape or not. They will give you feedback. And, you know, in the plane, that might be a slightly different vibration. When I'm winding a watch, it might be that I can feel just a little catch that didn't used to be there. But I think if we take the time to listen to the tools, we're both living more in the moment, which makes us happier, but we're also then able to use the tools longer and keep them in better shape and then hopefully pass them on to the next generation. Because, I mean, from my Leica to my airplane to my favorite watches, all these things are going to outlive me. And so I'm just a custodian of these fantastically engineered mechanical devices. And I want to be the best custodian that I can possibly be.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And while we're talking about, you know, kind of the relationship between cameras and watches and aviation, I mean, like, at what point when you were flying, or was it before you even got your license, did you realize that, like, oh, like, this and my love of photography can meet? Like, these two things can kind of feed off of one another instead of being separate.
I had no thought of combining photo and flight until I was far into the process. I think that when you fly commercial, you're so far up in the sky that you really don't get a sense for the rich views that happen just 1 or 2,000 feet up. And this is part of why, you know, drone photography started to get popular, right? But you start to see these patterns that are really interesting at low altitude. And when I got further into my career as a private pilot, I realized that there are these mid altitudes, maybe 5,000 feet up, that nobody else was traveling at. And the views there were stunning. And at first I, you know, would take an iPhone shot or two, or maybe I'd take a quick Leica shot. And then over time, as I got more comfortable and got to know my airplane, I felt that it was okay for me to start bringing in a real camera and actually shooting out the side of the plane, because I was getting inspired by the things I was seeing. And I wanted to take that back and use it as reference for commercial shoots I was doing, because there are patterns that you can see from the sky that I don't know how else you would ever dream this stuff up. So over time, it was really a slow growth and ended up kind of shifting how often I was able to fly, because then it became intertwined with my work. And all of a sudden it made a lot of sense for me in the afternoon, if I needed to go take a reset or figure out how to solve a creative brief, to go fly and bring the camera with me. Mm.
And that gets us to your career. You know, like, you are a private pilot, but that is not how you pay the bills, right? Like, you're a photographer and director as your day-to-day, correct?
Correct. That's what pays for the airplane bills.
Okay, perfect. And so how has that career evolved? Like, how did you end up? I mean, you mentioned that you bought a Leica in high school, so presumably you were, you know, already interested in photography by that point. But what's your sort of parallel photo journey that's kind of been simmering alongside this flight journey?
Yeah, the the Leica was something that I bought just for the love of a beautiful mechanical object, but never with the intention of becoming a photographer or a director. I was surrounded by people starting businesses when I went to college. I was pre-med and studying economics, and I always thought that the world of film and photo was a great thing to do on the side. And so I did it on the side. I figured it paid much better than flipping burgers. And so I started a little photo booth business when I was in high school, and that gave me enough cash to start to acquire more camera gear. And before I knew it, by the end of college, I was shooting so actively that I didn't even have time to recruit for a job. And so it was really just a career that happened to me. I had no long-standing belief that that was my one true calling. But I really loved telling stories. I loved working with people that made interesting products. I'm a huge fan of great product design. And it just turned out that because of the beginner's mindset I could get into when I had to learn a new industry each time that I would do a photo shoot, that was more engaging to me than sticking with one industry and going internal to a company and helping them run things.
And how would you describe the type of photography you do, since it's, you know, being a quote unquote photographer for a living is a pretty broad thing. So if what would you describe as your sort of like sub-discipline?
Yeah. So I unfortunately don't have a sub-discipline because I am so intentionally broad in what I do. Yesterday, I was shooting an ad campaign for a health foods company focused on coffee. Next week, I'm going to be working with a few chefs directing, you know, 5 to 6 minute documentary features. The work that I do is usually going to be with a brand that needs to tell a story and hasn't told stories in the past. What I love is helping people understand who've done more work on the product side of things and the brand side of things, how to grow to that next stage. And that's kind of the world that I live in. But it could be across any number of products or disciplines.
Okay. And the sort of photography you do professionally is mostly in a studio. It's pretty like contained. It's about controlling the environment. It's about getting everything dialed in pretty precisely, right? That's a fair characterization.
Absolutely fair.
And then the photography you're doing from the plane is like kind of the opposite. Like you have no control. You have no control over the, I mean, like, yes, you can approach from different angles to get the best sunlight. Like you can do all the things that a photographer is always doing if they're paying attention when they're making pictures. But like you're not bringing strobes. You're not telling the mountain where to stand, right?
Very true. And it's part of why before I did aerial work, I had never been as interested in the landscape world of shooting because I loved the control that came from a studio. But what kind of morphed as soon as I got into shooting out of the side of an airplane was that I realized there's a big similarity in that commercial studio work, which is quite precise, and the aerial work, which is precise in its own way, because they're both about preparation. And so for the aerial work, it's all about precision in the way that I fly the airplane. And that's where the training and kind of the pre-production comes in, versus in the studio work, it's all about bringing together a really good crew, making sure that everyone has agreed on storyboards and that we really love what we're going to try and tell. But at the end of the day, with both of them, it's preparation so that in the moment, you can throw all the plans out the window and just find the beautiful thing. And that's why they feel quite similar. At the end of the day, I'm equally exhausted and equally in love with what I get to do.
That's awesome. I love that. I love this idea of whether it's in photography, shooting while you're flying, just flying, of like you prepare so that in the moment you can kind of ignore what you prepared for, but then it's there in case you need it. That's a really nice way to approach things. And honestly, I'll be totally honest with you, that is kind of how I approach interviews. Like, you know, it's I can do all the prep I want in the world and I can write a million questions, but like once I get talking to somebody, like I'm not going to read a sheet of questions. Like that's going to be a terrible interview. It's going to be boring for me. It's going to be boring for you. The audience is going to be like, why am I listening to this? This is super weird. Nobody talks like this. But I think that's kind of like a good lesson in general in life. Like I don't know. It just feels like it's something that speaks to me a little more broadly.
I tend to find that the most exciting conversations, not that I've had nearly the interview experience you have, but when I work with subjects, it's the things that you can't find online because the things that so few people have in common. And it's those little sparks that are so exciting. Yeah. And that's usually where the magic happens. It's like, oh, wait, you love Monkey 47 gin. Like you're one of five people that I've talked to that love it, right? You like find these little niches and that's where the joy is, because then you've got a real human connection as opposed to, you know, what a lot of commercial work can look like, which is kind of staid and like you're trying to fit within a box. But most of us don't.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I mean, you also talk about you've mentioned going flying as a break, right? Like you'll be working on a job and you'll need to kind of like creatively recharge or work through a problem, and that like getting up in the air helps you with that. And I wonder, is there a way in which your flying and your commercial photography, or your commercial photography and your aviation photography, like, is there a way in which you think they kind of play off of one another? One feeds the other. Something you learn on one side can then be applied to the other.
Absolutely. I think that I'm not great at meditating. Mm. And part of that is because I really stopped meditating once I started flying. There's that level of focus, and it's this kind of calm focus, right? Because again, as long as nothing's going wrong, you can really be pretty relaxed, but you can never actually let your guard down entirely. At that point, you'd be unsafe. So when I go up and fly, a lot of the time, as I am in thought about the plane, that's when the most beautiful scene comes up. And I haven't thought about whatever the job is back at home. And I'm in that moment and I see that scene. And then there's going to be something about the light that I never would have thought to have created, because I'm flying and there's a cloud that just happened to appear. And that light hitting the tree, I see what it does. And I think, okay, that's the way to solve this. It's a light problem. Other times I'll see a pattern on the ground and say, oh, that's the way that we need to solve this one. It's a different prop styling direction. So the information, all credit to aviation, it usually goes from aviation to commercial. It doesn't really go back the other way quite as often. but I do credit plane for doing that. And sometimes in much subtler ways, where I'll go up and I won't think that anything has changed about how I'm about to solve a problem. And when I land and sit back down at the computer, sure enough, it takes 10 minutes and we figured out how to, you know, complete the brief and get something together that everyone's a bit more excited about.
Yeah, that's awesome. Are there any, I'm not asking about like harrowing stories, but have there been any times where you're up in the plane and you're shooting and all of a sudden there's like a tension between the photography and the flying, whether it's a shot that you can visualize and you really want to get it, but you're like not totally sure it's a safe move in the plane, or whether it's, you know, you're trying to fly, but like the photography is taking you in a different direction?
Some of the most beautiful landscapes happen when the earth is a little angry and the clouds are a little bigger. So there are often days that I am hitting my head so hard against the dang ceiling of the plane in turbulence that all I want to do is go down, and the light is perfect and there are these puffy clouds and there's nothing more that I want to do than stay up and keep on shooting. So that is a not too uncommon occurrence. Same thing, this last adventure I had, it was beautiful to see what the Tetons look like in the middle of winter. And it was a heck of a lot harder to fly there than it would have been in summer. So there's certainly a push-pull between some of the most beautiful weather moments also being ones where you've really got to be aware of what the outs are that you have and what the consequences would be if the weather continued to deteriorate.
Yeah, that makes total sense. All right, the last thing I want to ask you about, you know, before we talk a little bit about watches, because I think our audience would be kind of mad at me if we didn't do that a little bit. But you know, you and I could probably talk cameras all day. But you've mentioned Leica, and I think that's something a lot of folks listening have familiarity with. But you also are a big proponent of the Phase One camera system, and I wonder if you can just quickly tell us like how you got into shooting with Phase and why that's kind of your like tool of choice most of the time.
Phase One is one of the largest, clunkiest, and slowest cameras ever made. And I'm so madly in love with it, I wouldn't trade it for anything. If you kind of imagine, right, the old Hasselblad Mamiya medium format cameras that were the standard for so many decades, Phase tried to bring that level of quality into the digital world. And in doing that, they examined color science more carefully than any other manufacturer has. And so I can get things out of a file shot on my Phase One that I couldn't get out of any other camera in the world. And because of that, I have an ability to create unique images. At least I hope my clients find that value. And that's thrilling to me, because photography at the end of the day, it's playing with light, color, and pattern. And I'm able to manipulate light and color more powerfully with that system than I could with any other system. So coincidentally, I ended up getting my Phase right about the same time that I got the airplane. And it was because I was kind of this inflection point when I was trying to figure out what the next step in the career was going to be for me. I had a snowboarding accident. I was holed up for almost 8 weeks bedridden and really thinking about what do I want to do next? Because that was a time that I had to sit and think instead of go out and just continue to run. And I realized that instead of kind of continuing at a mid-level commercial work, I really wanted to aim for the highest quality work in the world. And as I examined what was going on in behind the scenes photos and videos of the biggest ad campaigns, I realized that a lot of people were using this camera and they were creating things I'd never been able to create. And I thought, well, the tool might be part of the answer. So let's go get the tool.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I've shot phase one a little bit and it is a totally different experience. It's a wild thing. I would say anyone who's listening who is interested in photography and is not familiar with those cameras, go check them out and try to get your hands on one for a little while. It's a pretty wild experience.
Yeah, it's a real eye-opener, I think, especially folks that enjoy cinema. The Phase is the only camera that has a dynamic range similar to an Arri Alexa or a Red or really all the things that Hollywood uses for feature films. And there's something that you can do in film with shadow and depth of light that most still photographers can't do. And the Phase kind of lets you tap into that world. And so it's a pretty exciting thing to get your hands on that and start to see how far you can push it. Mm-hmm.
Well, I love that, but I think we got to talk about watches a little bit. I could legitimately sit here and talk to you about stops of dynamic range for the next 45 minutes, and Gray would have to cut every bit of it and would kill me in production, but in post. But, you know, I mentioned that, you know, we first got to know each other through this IWC project, and, you know, one of your watches, well, I guess two of your watches are featured in that, you know, a modern Big Pilot, and then a vintage IWC that was your father's. And I think those two watches side by side are a really interesting pair and sort of two really interesting takes on what like a quote unquote like tool watch can be.
Yeah, my dad's watch was something that he spent years and years looking for, and I absolutely adore it. I wish that IWC would actually reissue it. And for him, it's the perfect tool watch because he's a federal prosecutor and he wanted a watch that he would absolutely love to wear every day that would give him, you know, the reverence for a beautiful piece of design whenever he looked down on it. But at the same time, he's prosecuting people for fraud on a regular basis, and he didn't want to show up with a big blingy watch as he's telling That's people fair. Why have you stolen from the U.S. government. So for him, you know, the need of a tool was quite different than for me as a pilot, where legibility is paramount. I need to be able to quickly look down and make sure that I'm, you know, switching fuel tanks at the right time, or that I know what my ETA is to a destination. And so I need a big-faced watch that allows me to instantly know what I'm going to do. And as you saw, sometimes we're flying in the middle of winter. I also need to be able to operate the Crown if it's a little windy out and I've got gloves on.
Yeah.
So our tools are quite different because our offices are quite different. But yeah, I adore both of the watches, and they hold a special place in both of our hearts.
That's awesome. How does the rest of your sort of watch collection and also just your like enthusiasm for watches manifest? Like where are your other sort of horological loves?
So I think you picked up on one of my habits pretty early on in this, which is marking events with either, you know, something like a flight or with a purchase. And so my other... the heaviest rotation watch is a Patek 5167. And I got that when my wife and I were married. And I adore it. It is the easiest wearing watch that I've ever had. And it's stunning. I mean, it's one of those things where when I got it, it was not nearly as popular as it's become. And she wears a Calatrava as her daily wear. And I had thought about getting one as well so that we'd be kind of matching. And I realized that I lead a more active lifestyle. And so having a rubber band stainless watch was of huge appeal. And the problem with getting that so early on in my watch appreciation is that it really makes it hard for me to find other things that I want to buy to boot that out of the lineup, because I love wearing it every day.
Yeah. It's tough. I mean, like I've encountered this as well. Like when you find a watch you really connect with, it like it almost like overshadows everything else, and you have to like find excuses to appreciate the other things because this one thing just kind of like takes up so much like intellectual and emotional space. But you know you want to get past it, but you also kind of don't.
Oh, and it's so funny too, because I'm going along the lines of loving a good tool. I love tool watches, and all I want is to have my favorite watch have a rotating bezel. Like I'm just dying for that to be the case. But every time that I try something out, I borrow it from a friend, it just doesn't compare to the connection that I have with my Aquanaut. And so then I end up wearing it again and missing it when I'm not. So that's the conundrum I've been in for a while. Although I will admit I've gotten really close a few times to pulling the trigger on a super compressor. There are because I think the next step for me in the watch journey is going the way that my father did and getting something vintage. Both of the watches that I, well, all three that I wear most often, I also wear a Seiko Prospects, which is just great for the times when we're in the rough and tumble areas and don't want to worry about dinging anything up, but still like a really solid watch. But I've been so close to getting a Longines super compressor, like a 7150 or a 7042 a few times, because there is something so gorgeous to me about that design. Yeah. But I haven't found the perfect one yet, and it could take a really long time.
Yeah, those are absolutely killer watches, and like, weirdly, kind of a great pilot's watch.
Yeah, that's part of the appeal for me. It's, they fulfill that, and then I'm also a scuba diver. So you've got really the main activities in life all covered with that one watch, and it really does something different than the Big Pilot or than the Aquanaut. So eventually, I think that's going to join the stable. But as you know better than I, once you start going into vintage watches, that example by example evaluation is a much slower process than deciding you like a reference number.
That's the start of the journey, not the end of the journey. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask how your relationships, I mean, we've talked a lot through these, you know, the three kind of main topics we've talked about are watches, aviation, and photography. And I know those are three kind of like big pillars in your life. They all have this sort of valence of like a relationship between you and a thing, a mechanical thing, no less. And then kind of like 1+1=3 there, you know, like what kind of new thing you can create or sort of way you can expand your life or your circle through these relationships with these mechanical things. And I wonder how you A, think about that more broadly, and B, if there are ways in which it's similar or different between these three categories of things, kind of like planes, cameras, and watches.
I think that in order to get 1+1=3, the tool has to be world-class. I'm this really big believer in buying something once, buying something for life. And you know, I know some great pilots and great watch collectors and great photographers, and it's just one thing in, one thing out on a regular basis. They're just horse trading left and right. And that's not my personality. You know, I bought one aircraft and I'm madly in love with it, and I don't know if I'll ever sell the thing. I have three watches and each of them are going to stay with me for life, and I'm going to pass them on to the next generation. And similarly with my cameras, you know, by getting to know your tool really well and by doing a lot of research and being honest with yourself about what you actually need out of the tool. I think a lot of people have these grand notions about what they're going to eventually do if they get this item that are just a crock of nothing. Like, they are so deluding themselves, right? If you get something, it's not going to make you tougher or smarter or faster.
Yeah.
But if you understand what it is you're trying to accomplish and then you really put in the time and get that tool, and then once you've gotten to realize, again, that's just the start of the journey. Now you actually have to learn how to use it and learn the things that no one else knows about that tool. Then 1+1=3. And that, to me, is a really rewarding process. It just takes a long time to do.
Yeah. No, I totally agree and completely relate. And I think, you know, you and I are both in the age range where, like, those things that the earliest things you bought that you felt that way about are now, like, starting to feel right. Like, they're settling in, you know? Like, I feel like I now have a handful of things I've owned long enough where I'm like, I'm confident that I wasn't lying to myself. Like, I actually am going to enjoy this thing forever. And I, like, really am building a relationship with it. It's not like this thing where, like, oh, I bought it and I've used it for 6 months and ha ha ha, I'm going to have it forever and pass it down to my kids. But, like, you really get to, like, get into that relationship and it feels good. It's a good thing.
I think you have to have enough time really to go through cycles. I'd be deluded if I said that with each of those things that I love now, I acquired them and there hasn't been a time or two where I've thought about getting rid of them or when I've been frustrated by them.
Totally.
And until you have the patience to go through those cycles and the time and the age to do it, then I don't think you can be honest and say, I'm going to keep this forever. But when you've done that half a dozen times and thought about selling it and broken it and repaired it and loved it and had it really see you through a tough time, then that starts to become a genuine sentiment and a bond has really been formed.
Yeah. Well, there's a few kind of random topics that I want to make sure we get to, just stuff that I think I find interesting selfishly and that I think hopefully our listeners will find interesting. One kind of relates to what we were just talking about a little bit, which is a quote I absolutely love from you, which is, you're a jack of all trades and a master of none, but none is often better than one. Can you unpack that for me a little bit?
Happy to. As we try to compartmentalize everything in our lives in order to make it easier to understand, we often trim away the fat, right? We get rid of the stuff that we don't think is necessary. And everybody has heard Jack of all trades, master of none. But I don't think a lot of people realize that that used to be a two-sentence sentiment. We've just deleted part of it because that was easier. And I love the fact that in years past, people understood that there is something to being a Renaissance person, that there is a great richness to life if you have an appreciation for all trades and all of the different facets of a daily experience. So learning how to make the perfect espresso can be every bit as rewarding as learning how to make more money on the stock market so you can buy more espressos. Both of those things are equally valuable. And I try to embrace that with my work when I am often asked by people, you know, oh, do you shoot, you know, liquids or do you shoot cars or something else? It's like, well, there's still a camera. There's still light. We can figure out how to do any of those things. And I'm very intentional about making sure one of them does not dominate the rest.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I absolutely love that. In terms of your other interests, you know, as we talk about, you know, master of none, but many things that you're interested in, you're a big cooking guy, aren't you?
You know, I grew up with a mom who went to culinary school and thought that she was going to become a pro chef and worked in kitchens for a little while and then just realized that that wasn't really conducive to having a kid and spending a lot of time with them. So I was really fortunate that whereas most of my chef friends, when they go home, they're not really ready to cook because they've just been doing that for the last 16 hours. Well, she put all of that love of food and just channeled it into our household. So I thought it was really normal that on Tuesday afternoon, you could say, well, can we have chocolate souffle for dessert to go with that whole roast chicken that we're having? That sounds really good.
It's pretty incredible.
Yeah. So, you know, I absorbed a lot of that growing up and just really had so many deep experiences of bonding with family over food that it would have been pretty hard to come out of that childhood and not want to cook and share nourishment with all those that you love.
Yeah. I'll admit the Snowpeak envy and the Wagyu envy is real. Sometimes I'm flipping through my Instagram stories and it kind of kills me as I think about what I'm going to be eating for dinner.
You know, the obsession has gotten pretty far with Snowpeak. For those who don't know it, it's this Japanese outdoors brand. And as only a brand from the other side of the world could do, they have figured out how to simultaneously create some of the like most tough, lightweight titanium mountaineering gear, but also some of the best outdoor kitchen equipment that is designed so that you can pretty much have your entire family go out and eat a five-star meal in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. So that the entire family will enjoy the process of camping. And I'm fortunate that I was able to justify that because my wife never wanted to go camping before we met, like no interest at all. And as I kept on asking her if there was a way that I could make it more intriguing, she said, well, look, at the end of the day, I just don't want to eat bad food and sleep outside. I said, what if we eat good food and sleep outside? She's like, well, I think I could handle that.
It's meeting halfway, right?
Yeah, it's part of the process. So that began this deep dive into Japanese grills and their very special charcoals that they have that burn hotter than American ones. And now we've ended up, you know, toting bags of Japanese oak and 30,000 BTU burners into the middle of the backcountry just so that we can have a nice little yakitori night and keep everybody happy.
That's absolutely incredible. I love that. I think if I could justify buying some of the Snowpeak gear, I might camp more. That might get me out. I think I'm in the same camp here as your wife.
It's back to that, you know, when something is so well designed that you just can't wait to use it again.
Yeah,
you're looking for an excuse to get it out.
Yeah, it's like I'll do basically anything at a super high level. Like if you can be like, we're going to do this thing, but we're going to do it in an insane way. Like I'm game to try it. Like I just love that idea of like doing something superlatively. So yeah, okay, we're going to go camping and we're going to do it. We're going to fly our own plane to the backcountry and we're going to whip out this amazing Japanese meal with this crazy titanium camping gear. Like, cool. Like, I'm totally game for that as a person for whom, like, camping is normally, like, a Holiday Inn. Like, that's my version. But, yeah, it's a pretty cool thing and it's super fun to watch. So I haven't said this yet, which is crazy. We've gotten this far and I haven't said this, like, we're going to link up to your Instagram handle in the show notes. Like anyone who is not following you, who's listening to this, please go follow Evan. Like You will be so jealous and so excited every time you see something pop up. Absolutely go do that. So I can't believe we made it this far without me doing that. That's kind of wild.
Well, and I can't believe we made it this far without getting you in the plane, in the back country, so that we can actually share one of these meals together. So as soon as it's safe to do so,
ASAP.
We've got to get out there so that you'll be on that Instagram also, and we'll get to make some memories around the campfire.
Would love it. Well, I guess the last thing is just, do you have anything fun or exciting coming up that you want to plug? Any projects, anything you're really excited about, anything you think people should check out?
You know, I think you kind of touched on it with the love of Wagyu. Right now I'm working on a project that I'm pretty excited about with this company called Westhome. They're an Australian Wagyu company. And what's great to me about it is that, you know, we're in the middle of a really tough year and a half now. And trying to find some positives to this chaos and sadness is something that I think helps me maintain some sanity. I don't have a lot left, but there's a little bit.
Yeah.
And what we've gotten to do is shoot this series of 6-minute, roughly, documentaries with world-class chefs cooking at their houses. And I've always loved cooking, and I've never been more tired of cooking than during quarantine. It just got to be so exhausting. And then when we talk about marking these, you know, celebrations and special occasions, it's really tough to do when you can't eat out, because meals used to be the way we would do that.
Yeah.
And so I hope that with this series, we're able to kind of show people how they can relook at the way they're cooking at home, learn something from a chef that never would have taken the time, had the time to film with us, because usually they'd be in these professional kitchens operating at the highest level. I mean, we have Tim Hollingsworth, who spent a decade at the French Laundry, now is at Odeon here in LA. We have Chris from Night Market, who's made one of the best salads I've ever had in my life with Australian Wagyu. So I'd love for people to go check that out and see if they might actually kind of get inspired to look at the way they're cooking at home a little bit more, because it'll make you a little healthier and a little happier, and maybe give you an idea about how to celebrate in a time when it's still worth remembering to celebrate things. You got to have some wins.
I absolutely love that and could not think of a better note to end this on. So, dude, thank you so much for doing this. As soon as things get a little less wild here in LA, we definitely have to connect. I will 1,000% be taking you up on the offer of a nice trip in the plane. And hopefully we can hang out soon.
Thanks so much for having me on. Hi to Gray, the whole rest of the crew. It's great to connect. And yeah, can't wait to get you out there, and we'll have a great time.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Take care.
Ciao.
Up next, Kara joins me to discuss why all watches should be unisex. Hey, CB, how's it going?
Hey, Stevie. How are you?
I'm good. It's Friday. You know, ready for a little weekend action. It's been a busy week at Hodinkee HQ, but...
TGIF, I know, seriously.
Yeah.
Can't believe it's actually Friday, so very exciting.
Yeah,
same. I'm gonna sleep a lot this weekend, I think. So.
Yeah, you've earned it, for sure.
I need a nap.
Yeah, I need a nap. I feel like we should get team shirts made that just say, I need a nap.
I need a nap.
The Hodinkee logo on the back.
It's nap time.
A watch that just says nap at all 12-hour markers. I would wear, honestly, I'd wear that watch.
I'll put that in for the limited edition lineup in 2022.
Perfect. I knew you were the right person to talk to here. Well, this week, I mean, one of the highlights on Hodinkee this week, and one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show, was that you wrote a pretty incredible column to kick off this new rubric, Second Opinions. And the headline is, All Watches Should Be Unisex, and Here's Why. And to say that this, like, caused a kerfuffle on the watch internet this week would be, like, probably an understatement.
Watch land, as I think someone so wonderfully put it.
Yeah, it caused quite a stir. And I think, you know, I think this is a thing we should be talking about. It's a thing we should have been talking about for much longer. And the thing that, like, I know internally, like, we talk about all the time, but, I think it was good to get some thoughts out there. So I figured, you know, we'll start off. I want to get some of, like, the stuff from the article just out there for people who maybe haven't had a chance to read it, which it's in the show notes. Please go read it. This whole segment will make way more sense and be way more fun if you've read the story. But then, you know, I want to chat with you and talk through some stuff that some commenters brought up, some of our colleagues across the industry have brought up, and really kind of go just one layer deeper. Does that work for you this morning?
That works for me. I'm ready.
Amazing.
Ready as I'll ever be.
So I guess the first thing to do is just like, if somebody hasn't read the article, or if you were trying to like give somebody your take on the article, what's like the elevator pitch here? What's the like TLDR version of this story?
Yeah, I think, you know, well, first of all, Second Opinions, it's just to clarify, is not going to be the title of my monthly column. It's right. just a new rubric that we have about opinions. So it's just the individual writer's opinion. So it could be anything from Watchers Should Be Unisex to I Hate a Date Window and totally. So on and so forth. So like, just so the audience knows, like they have that to look forward to. So it's to encourage people to kind of just talk about things that we all want to talk about. And something that I have always wanted to talk about, but necessarily didn't have the confidence or the words to kind of express how I feel about watches and being a woman in the watch industry. So for me, this piece was really just to kind of get that conversation started about how women still feel a little bit like outsiders in this hobby. It's still very male oriented. Jenny L has recently published a video on the history of women's watches and the marketing of women's watches, which is so fascinating. Highly recommend it. People watch it. And the, you know, just kind of exploring my feelings on it. And so there's jewelry watches, and those are like the Serpentis of the world. Sure. And those have a place and they're wonderful. And I think there's a place for quote unquote ladies watches and quote unquote men's watches. But for me, the biggest thing is I really want to see brands talking to women differently about watches. And that includes all the watches that they make. And I think that is something that will help consumers as well as women who might be interested in watches but don't know that they're interested in watches get interested in watches. Because representation, I think, as we all know, at least now, hopefully the memo has gotten across, representation is really important. And so I think that kind of showcasing traditional men's watches on women, not as a sex object, might I add, is a caveat there, because I, you know, some brands do it, but it's gross. And so I think it's important to really show women products that might interest them, that because of the tastes have changed.
Yeah.
So that's a really all over the place answer.
No. I mean, I think
it's a complicated topic.
That's exactly.
Right. So
I mean, that's
hard to talk about.
That's the thing. Is like it's a complicated topic, and there's a lot to cover, and there's a lot of different sort of facets to this. So, you know, let's kind of walk through. There's a couple things from the article itself I wanted to pull out and kind of get your extended thoughts on. This is the liner notes, basically. You know, in the opening graph of the story, you're talking about your own collection, and you say, I don't see any conventional ladies pieces. And the idea of conventional ladies watches, right? Like that already gets us like really deep into the heart of this, right? Like, what are quote unquote conventional ladies watches? Why do we think of them that way? Like, these are pieces of metal. Like, these things have no inherent sort of like gender qualities to them. Any gender we see in them is something we've put into them. So I wonder, maybe when you say like conventional ladies pieces, like, A, what specifically are you talking about? And B, like, why do you think those watches have become thought of as conventional ladies pieces?
Yeah, I think for me, I think of a conventional ladies piece being like a 1950s cocktail watch.
Okay.
Like super small, thin bracelet. It can be manual, but like that to me is a conventional ladies wristwatch.
Does it have gems on it in your mind?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes. But I think because that was the style then, that it made sense. But now we've come to an era where women are dressing differently, women are working more, women are making more money. Women have a stronger buying power than ever before. So tastes and style has changed and evolved. And I don't know that the modern traditional ladies' watch has caught up with that. And it's not because I don't think it should exist. I love traditional ladies' watches. I love like the Maison de Cartier. I think it's really special. I think there's a time and place for it. I think there's also a time and place for a Submariner. And so I think it's kind of about figuring out how we can make women who don't necessarily like traditional ladies' watches feel like they're spoken to with more traditional men's watches. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you also say in the story, and I'll quote you at you again, which I know is like the most annoying thing.
No, I know. And
do.
Also, like,
I hate it when people do it to me, but like, I'm going to do it to you. Why not? This isn't about the watches. This is about the approach to seeing them and how outdated it is. And like, the products are a problem. Like, we know that. Like, you know, I won't slag off anybody here right now by name. I won't.
Yeah,
that's probably for a different forum. But like, if I see one more brand send me a press release for Valentine's Day with a like $50,000 gold watch with fucking pink hearts and diamonds all over it, like, what am I supposed to do with that? Like, what the fuck does a thinking human being do with that in 2021? Like, I just, that's astounding. But if we set that aside, right, that's a problem. But those are like, you can isolate those incidents. The things you can't isolate are the broader strategies coming from these watch brands and how watches are viewed and how they clearly view their customer base, right?
Right. So I think that's kind of the crux of the issue also. And to speak to the specific Valentine's Day onslaught of pitches and emails and things, the Jenny L video really nailed it on the head for me as far as marketing is concerned. If you look at traditional men's watch marketing campaigns and ad campaigns, it always shows the watch on a dude doing something. He's scaling a mountain. He's diving. He's the president. He's, you know, it's always from a first person perspective. And it's like, hey guys, if you buy this watch, you'll be cool like this guy. And it's like, that's the message, right?
And then you take a look, like you said, though, it's first person, right? Like, it's, you can see yourself doing something, right?
Exactly.
Like, you're supposed to imagine yourself as the person in the ad, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then if you take a look at women's marketing campaigns, it's always a supermodel. It's always someone who's, you know, dressed a certain way. The watch isn't even fitted to her wrist half the time. It's like kind of drooping. And it's always from the male gaze. I never look at them and be like, man, I want to be like her.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I'm not.
I'll
never be like her.
I'll be less diplomatic about it. Like, it's always some skinny white lady who's been airbrushed within an inch of her life, wearing a fucking tulle gown, sitting on like a Regency era sofa. And like, it's complete being, like you said, clearly looked at by the person viewing the advertisement,
exactly.
Not being embodied by the person looking at the advertisement.
Yeah.
It's like kind of
so, like,
creepy,
you know,
actually.
I think it's something that just like so few women actually aspire to be that way. Do you know what I mean? So it's never like, I want to see like, and maybe I'm an anomaly, right? So like, again, like, this is just my opinion. Like, I want to see some like badass chick in a boardroom. Like, that's something that I would aspire to want. I'm sure other women aspire to be a pilot. You know what? So there's all these different things where I just think they're kind of like missing, or like, some women just want to be chic. That's all they care about. Like, they want to see some like fashion forward woman walking the streets of New York wearing a cool watch. That's it.
Yeah.
It's really that simple. Like, I think the issue is the ads are still targeted to men.
Yeah.
So there's no ads that are ever targeted to women at all. And it's still, I think that's the real miss. It's just kind of, they're still kind of stuck in the mindset of, oh, women aren't going to buy themselves a watch. So we're going to target men to buy one for her, which is fine. I'm all about nice gifts. Don't get me wrong. But at the same time, I know brands are focused on growing their female consumer base. I think, you know, most of them have roughly 30 to 40% female buyers, which is fantastic. That number is actually higher than I would expect. But to get that number higher, you do have to start talking to women differently.
Yeah.
And I think that that for me was really the like, oh, this is what it should be. And I think a lot of people in the comments, at least, were very fixated on the unisex aspect of the article, where it was like, let's do away with labels. And it's tricky. I see that opinion, right? So like, I get what people are saying, where it's like, oh, you can't get rid of the labels. Like, that's not going to do anything. But for me, the bigger picture issue is the way that women are spoken to in the industry.
Yeah.
And as consumers.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, like, I have not checked, but I will check right now. People are getting a live look at the process. You can maybe hear me typing. But like, let's take one of the most popular watches in the world, right? Like the Nautilus. It's just discontinued, 5711, you know, great. The 5711 isn't explicitly labeled by Patek as a men's watch. And I want to make it clear too, like, the reason I'm picking on Patek here, or as it will become apparent in a minute, is not entirely picking on Patek here, is like, they're big boys. Like, they can handle this. They're big boys and big girls. And like, this is not punching down. Like, Patek can stand up to this. So I have very purposefully chosen them here. So this is not a punching bag situation.
No, and they actually do, their recent 24 ad campaigns have been really focused on women in power.
Yeah, which I think is interesting. And I think the fact that Patek does not explicitly label their watches men's watches or women's watches. However, like, have you ever seen an ad for the 5711 with a woman in the boardroom? No, it's some dude and his son, you know, either on a yacht or, you know, playing golf or whatever. And even, and that seeps down into the product as well, where we've seen that, like, the smaller Nautilus, they put the wavy dial and the diamonds on them almost to, like, keep men in Western markets where that's not popular from buying them, which is, like, it's a really weird and fascinating strategy. But, like, there are, all of that is to say, like, there are ways to do this other than labeling, you know, there are ways to make it clear to your customers who products are targeted at. And, like, anybody who wants to buy them can buy them. But, like, there are ways to hint at people, like, we're making this because we think this group of people will like it. Or we're making this because we think this group of people will like it. And, like, that's all fine. But I think if I'm hearing you correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, is one of the bigger problems is, like, watch brands telling customers how they can and can't enjoy their products, or should or shouldn't enjoy their products. And I think that seeps through, that kind of culture becomes a part of the enthusiast culture as well. And
right,
you reference it in the story, but, like, our Talking Watches with Bethany was a perfect example of this, where, like, people are still bitching and moaning in the comments that, like, oh, she didn't really like her watches. She didn't show the right kind of passion. And it's like, I'll drop another F-bomb because we've already got the explicit tag on this article. Why not? Like, fuck you. Who are you to tell this person how they can and can't enjoy the things in their life? Like, I don't show up at your house and tell you oversalted your dinner. I don't show up at your house and tell you the car is the wrong color for your personality. Like, you get to buy the stuff you want and enjoy it how you want. And if you like it and it makes you happy, good. And I just think that culture, I think, starts kind of at the top and seeps down, or at the bottom and seeps up. I'm not quite sure which one.
Yeah. You know, it's complicated because I think there's, like, two things going on. So there's, like, as you said, like, the way that brands speak to their female consumers is one thing. And then with the enthusiast base, there's this, like, culture of, like, watch snobism of, like, how much you know, like, oh, you don't know enough, I know more. And, like, I don't know if that's because it's more of, like, and, like, this is a gender stereotype, so, like, shame on me, but, like, I don't know if it's because it's more male
That's not a gender stereotype. Dudes on the internet are terrible. Okay. As a dude who has been on the internet most of my life, dudes on the internet are awful.
I know, and I know women are too. So like, I really want to avoid those being like, shame on you, like you're a bad person, like blah blah blah. Like I really, really want to avoid that because the full intention of this article was to have like a healthy conversation about it, and not it be this like less, you know, shame, like lesson in shame, like, you know what I mean? Like, totally. I don't want that, because like it's really about like bringing more people in.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where the watch snobism has always kind of rubbed me the wrong way, and I wonder if it rubs a lot of people the wrong way, whether you're a woman or a man, or whether you're and when you're new to the watch community, like some people don't care and they just go really deep and then they like really teach themselves. But I think a lot of women just want to like talk about nice things, you know what I mean? They just want to talk about watches and feel comfortable and feel like they're not being like told like, oh, you're not welcome here, you don't know enough. And so I think that to me is like a separate watch enthusiast cultural issue. And I do wish that it was less so that, because then it came out, and the Bethany video is a perfect example of that, because it really came out in that video.
Yeah.
And that bothered me. I felt very annoyed by that, because I want, like, if you're a woman and we're going to you to be our second Talking Watches female guest, what are you going to do? You're going to go look at the first one, and you're going to go look at the comments, yeah, and you're saying, why would I want to ever do this?
Agreed. Yeah.
Like, why would I want to do this?
Completely.
No one here
agreed.
Is nice. Like, that's literally, you know what I mean? So I think, again, it's not like I'm not trying to shame anyone, but I do think sometimes we get a little too passionate, and I think it's passion's great, but we'll just, reel it in. Like, everyone just needs to take a deep breath, like it's just watches. And I also want to make that point, like, this is just watches. Like, I realize that we're not saying, like, you know, this is not some like massive feminist movement. It's like this is just a hobby, so like we should all really enjoy it and be nice about it. So that's that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Like, the idea that like anyone thinks that like watches are not a thing that everyone can enjoy, like, I feel totally comfortable saying like, fine, go away. Like, we don't want to hear from you. Like, if you want to exclude other people, go do it somewhere else. Like this, it's so silly. Like, there are so many things going on in the world, and watches are an escape, and they're fun, and they're a place where we can find community and have a hobby that we can share and, you know, do it across the world. And in this case, do it virtually, since we can't be seeing each other. And like, if that upsets you, and what you want is for there to be fewer people, or fewer people who don't look like you or act like you or have the same opinions as you, like, since I'm on a roll today, like, fuck you.
Stevie,
like,
is on,
like,
a roll.
Go away. I just have no patience for this. Like, I just don't understand. I mean, somebody commented. Yeah. I wrote this down in the comments. I'm debating about, I won't call them out by name, but you can go find it in the comments. The quote is, why stop at watches? Why not make all people unisex too? Like, that's the most like bullshit, bad faith, like garbage argument. And if you think that, like, go away. Like, I don't want you reading Hodinkee. Like, I work hard on this. Kara works hard on this. Everyone else on the team, I think, probably agrees. Like, go somewhere else. Like, we don't want you here. This is not a, if you think that way, this is not a place for you. Like, this is a place of inclusivity. This is a place where we want everyone, and we want everyone to be excited and welcoming. And like, I don't know. I think that was the real heart of your column. Like, to me, my big takeaway was like, yes, we can argue about the minutiae of product development. Yes, we can argue about some pretty big problems in marketing departments. But like, ultimately, what this is really about is that like, watches should be a place for everyone. And anything in the watch world that creates barriers or could be exclusionary, like, we should just get rid of it or find an alternative. I mean, is that's to me the takeaway. Did I get it, or did I miss it?
Yeah, that was the crux of the article.
Yeah.
You got it. Yeah. It's just about being more inclusive, and I think I think even just talking about it, and I got a lot of women reached out to me after, and even within the company, and outside the Hodinkee, and you know, through Instagram and stuff. And I think just talking about it kind of like address this like weird thing that's like just kind of like under the surface that like no one really wants to talk about, because it's like kind of, it's because it's complicated and like kind of weird. And so I think kind of just even talking about it, it just made people feel more comfortable and like more empowered to be into watches. Because like at the end of the day, like I just want to nerd out with people over the fact that like Rolex discontinued the OP39. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I want to be upset about that with people. Right. Like, you know, that's where I, you know, that's the joy I find in this community is like, you're like, oh, how could you do that? Or like, oh my God, did you see that? Like, you know, and kind of knowing the nuances. And, you know, I don't also want this to be like people, the industry to be like, oh my God, like blah, blah, blah. Cause I love the watch industry. I find it so fascinating. And like, that's actually what my column will be about, like moving forward, is the industry, if they'll keep talking to me. So, you know,
I think you're safe.
Hopefully people will still want to talk to me and give me quotes and stuff. So, you know, I don't want to let anyone down, but it's not, my column every month is not going to be like guns blazing, like, you know, hot topic every month. But you know, it's a fascinating industry, and it's a small but mighty one, and there's so much to talk about and like so much to explore. And I just want to see more women get into it, because I think it's fun.
Awesome. Yeah, I completely agree. I think you did a really great job, and I think, you know, to me, the biggest takeaway here is that there's a lot of conversation left to be had. I mean, at the time of us recording this, there's 514 comments on the original story. We then published, for people who aren't aware, we published a story highlighting some of the most interesting comments after the first like 36 hours. And that story has over 100 comments. Like you said, Jenny published a really great video recently. Friend of Hodinkee, former contributor, Felix Schultz, had a really great thread on his Instagram story that we'll link to.
That was really good.
Really, really smart stuff from Felix. And there's a whole bunch of other folks across the industry, women, men, who had really interesting takes kind of in the wake of yours, or things that, you know, to give people full credit here, I don't want to slight anybody, like, a lot of really smart people in the industry and outside the industry have been thinking about this for a long time and have been having conversations elsewhere. And I think, you know, your column really allowed, you know, a moment to exist for people to say like, yeah, hey, like I've been thinking about this too, and I have opinions, and I think that's great. Yeah. And I think it's important that we acknowledge all those voices. So I would say if this is a topic you're interested in, we'll have some links down in the show notes where you can find other conversations about this. Cause, we don't want to monopolize.
No, I'm certainly not the first to have these thoughts or opinions. And I know people have spoken out about them before, other women in the industry. It's, you know, I am fortunate enough to work somewhere with a large platform and felt like it was just kind of time, you know, the tipping point.
Yeah.
So it's exciting. I'm honestly like, I hope, you know, my only hope is that like, things get a little different and like we see different stuff, and like ultimately that's what makes the world go round, right? It's like change. Can't avoid it, and it's like that's what, you know, that's what we want to see. So I don't know, it's exciting. Hopefully we'll see. I don't know.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on to talk about this. I'm glad we could have this chat. I mean, we could have probably made this like a 2 or 3 episode arc of us.
I don't think people want to hear that.
I don't think so either. We'll probably do that over over a beer or a glass of whiskey or a glass of Sabi beer, if we're being real, later. Awesome. Well, thanks, CB.
Off the record wine time.
Yeah, exactly. That'll be our other podcast, is Off the Record Wine Time with Cara and Steven.
It'll never see the light of day.
Never. That's the secret feed. But sweet. Thanks so much for doing this, and enjoy your weekend, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks, Stevie. Thanks for having
me. Awesome. Thanks, CB.
Bye.